Hello and welcome to Patron Deities, a show about deities for my patrons. I'm James Holloway and I'm reading my way through the Deities and Demigods supplement for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 1st Edition. And as I do, I'm talking about the gods, heroes, mythological beings that I find in it, and how to use them and religion and mythology more generally in your fantasy role-playing games. In today's episode, we're continuing our journey through the Celtic Mythos section of Deities and Demigods. And we're going to be talking about one of the Irish deities probably most represented in popular culture. And, you know, I think actually paradoxically because such a popular figure, maybe one that I don't have that much to say about. But let's start with Manannán Mac Léir, the god of the sea. Now, Mac Léir just means apparently the son of the sea, although I guess there is some debate about that etymology. What's interesting is that although he's presented here very much as a sea god, in the myths that he appears in, or in the tales that he appears in, he's rather more varied than that. He doesn't just do sea stuff, he does supernatural being stuff more generally. And that seems to be the case with a lot of Irish deities, that they resist the kind of God of X, God of Y classification that's so popular in Dungeons & Dragons. So certainly, Manannán is a god of the sea, he has a magic boat, he has a horse that can run on water, he has all kinds of sea stuff, and he's got some kind of sea-adjacent things, like he has a cloak of mist that he can use to make himself or others invisible. But a lot of the time he appears more as a kind of god of magic or deception than just a god of the sea. And if you want to say that those are images that are pretty easy to associate with the sea, I won't disagree with you. The sea is a secret. So we can see Manannán as a mysterious figure who represents the flowing and boundless nature of magic, just as the sea is also flowing and boundless. I mean, I know it's bounded, but you know what I mean. He's not like Salty McWavington. One of the ways in which he's connected with other figures of Irish mythology is through the practice of fosterage. Now, fostering the child of living parents was a very important aspect of many late antique and early medieval cultures. You get this in kind of the Viking Age as well, where it's a common way to build ties between families, and maybe a foster child kind of acts as a hostage, but it's also a demonstration of trust between two kin groups. So we know, for example, that Manannán was the foster son of the Dagda, who we talked about earlier, back in the first episode of this series, and he was the foster father of no less a personage than Lu. So those are some pretty important connections, and also his various children are fostered with various deities of the pantheon, or at least figures of these legends. He seems to have been a very popular character in Irish literature because he turns up in a lot of different tales, sometimes as an important character and other times just kind of as a background figure. I've talked before about a number of characters who really only appear in one or two sources. You know, for Dian Cecht, I think we had a handful, maybe three or four texts, but for Manannán, that's not true. He's in a bunch of stuff. Irish legend is often divided into different cycles, the mythological cycle, the cycle of the kings, the Ulster cycle, and he's in pretty much all of them in one form or another. Manannán is often associated with, a bit like Arran, as being someone who is a guide or gatekeeper of the other world, of that kind of undefined other dimension that is maybe like fairyland or maybe it's the afterlife. And sometimes he talks about this idea that he comes from a faraway land. And this, I guess, goes hand in hand with the idea of being a sea god. I suppose it sort of makes sense, you know, that if you visualize, like, who is the god that would be associated with going to a faraway land? Well, it would be the god of the sea, particularly if you're from island cultures. They have traditions of stories of fabulous voyages. In fact, we talked about Welsh sources that describe Arran's otherworld, Annwn, as being a set of islands. So he fits into that tradition, I suppose, this idea of a voyager and of someone who, like, facilitates or prevents the voyages of others. Interestingly, in some of the sources where he's described, in medieval sources in particular, he's not mentioned as sea god at all. He's not said to be a god, but they say that he's, you know, a magician and a scholar, but they don't particularly say he's has power over the sea. Maybe he's the son of the sea, but that isn't quite the same thing. He's also associated with generosity, and like pretty much any other character in Irish mythology, at one point in the stories, he's got a magic cow. So I think that this is an excellent character for someone to be devoted to. You know, clerics of sea deities in most D&D campaigns don't do very much. So, in fact, in my old D&D campaign, I had 8 sort of primitive human gods who were night and day, life and death, fire and water, sky and earth. You know, fortunately, the clerics for my game, there were 2 cleric PCs at different points in the campaign, and they chose to be clerics of life and death. But I don't know what I would have done if I had a water cleric, right? Because in general, if you have water deity powers, you're kind of the Aquaman of the group. You know, you're useful when there's a seafaring adventure, but seafaring adventures happen a lot less than you might think. A lot less than the creators of the Monster Manual seem to have thought, for example. But here we have a sea god who's associated with maybe, you know, things that are symbolically linked to the sea, as well as the sea itself. So you're not just busting out your useful sea god powers when you're on a boat, you're also able to affect areas that are going to be more relevant for an adventuring party, and I think that that's really useful. You know, one of the things that the Deities and Demigods book sometimes tries to do is take these figures and turn them into something a little bit more like Bryony McWavington. So Mananon in Deities and Demigods has attributes that the literary character has. So for example, he has his sword, Answerer, which I believe here is translated as Retaliator, but he also has like armor made from seashells and a trident that sucks the moisture out of people. I don't believe that those have literary origins, although if someone can point me to the text, I'm happy to be corrected. But I think sometimes with these deities, there's a sense that Jim Ward feels like maybe they're not cliche enough. Now, that sounds critical, but I've spoken before about how broad characterizations are actually sometimes necessary. Sometimes you've got a character whose nature you want to convey very quickly, and it's just not feasible to like go into a lot of depth about them. If you encountered this god as he's depicted in the medieval Irish sources, you might not really get a clear sense of his deal because he's actually a rather ambiguous character who appears in different ways in different sources. So sometimes, if you want to make sure that like people who look at the pantheon go, oh yeah, that's the sea god, you got to sea god him up a bit in a way that maybe you normally wouldn't. So personally, I wouldn't do that kind of embellishment, but I can see why in some campaigns, particularly where he didn't play a more important role, you might want to give him some game features that made it more obvious that he was the god of the sea. Now, next up we have another character from the Mabinogion, and that's Math. And I don't necessarily see that the character depicted here is actually all that similar to the character from Welsh literature. Here he's described as being this great magic user. I'm not so sure about that. I mean, okay, he's definitely a kind of borderline magical character in the Mabinogion. Like, he's a king, but he has all kinds of magical powers and magical restrictions, including that he must always sit with his feet in the lap of a virgin. And there's quite a lot of shenanigans surrounding finding an appropriate young lady for him to rest his feet on. But other than that, even the story that bears his name in the Mabinogion, Math, son of Mathonwy, it's not really about him so much as, like, he's the inciting incident for the other characters to go around and do stuff. So he's sort of interesting. I'm glad he's in here, kind of, although the him that's in here isn't all that similar to his literary counterpart, but I'm not really sure why, out of all the weird characters in the Mabinogion, this is the one that you would pick. Because he's interesting mainly as an example of a type of character who might appear in a campaign inspired by this type of legend, which is to say, you could very well have a character who's quite powerful, but whose power was limited by all the various restrictions and taboos that he had to follow. So he's fine, but I don't know that he necessarily, you know, in terms of characters from that body of tales, it's odd. You know, maybe they felt that a lot of the other characters overlapped with Arthurian characters. That's a possibility, as we'll see when we get to the Arthurian mythology section. And then finally, we have the deity probably everybody's been waiting for, the Morrigan. Now, I looked for sources on this pronunciation. It's a little bit tricky because, of course, you know, are we going to find people pronouncing it in modern Irish. These are obviously medieval stories, so is it more authentic to use the medieval Irish pronunciation? And there does seem to be a good deal of variation. The stock English version, like the name of the character from Darkstalkers and what have you, seems to be Morrigan with a short I, but I think that the accent over the I makes it longer, that it's Morrigan, like an E sound. But I mean, again, I don't speak Irish. I'm probably wrong, but that's the impression I get. Now, she is described in the Deities and Demigods book as a war goddess, and that is probably right. In fact, there's a fun mechanic that says that if your character, you know, worships her and runs away from a battle, there is a small chance that she'll be watching at that moment and strike them dead. So don't do that. Her name may mean something like Great Queen, but another interpretation, and maybe one that's actually more likely, is something like Phantom Queen, which is a pretty good name. In some medieval Irish texts, the term is used to gloss Latin terms. So, like, one of the ways in which we know what these words meant in, not just in Irish, but you get this in Old English as well, is when they are used to translate Latin words, or, you know, words from other languages that we do know. So we have sources where the word Morrigan is used as a translation for sources in other languages that say things like specter or female monster. It may be that there's the Morrigan, and then there's also like this category of just kind of Morrigans in general, evil spirits of some kind. And in fact, she's often portrayed as multiple, as having three forms. Sometimes these are like three versions of herself. Sometimes she has three daughters. She often turns herself into a crow, which again is associated with battle. She's a goddess of battle. And the crow is, you know, one of the birds of ill omen, that's a bird of the battlefield. But also she turns herself into other animals as well, as shape-shifting seeming to be an important part of any Irish deity. She appears not only in the mythological cycle, but also in the Ulster cycle, where she acts as a kind of antagonist to Cú Chulainn. But she's a very rule-bound antagonist, so at one point she's wounded three times by Cú Chulainn, but later on she appears as a lady who gives him some milk, and every time she gives him a drink of milk, he blesses her, and then the blessings heal her wounds. So there's a lot of that kind of fairy tale stuff. Now, like other Irish mythological figures, she appears in the Battle of Mortara, and apparently, now I'm only reading this in English translation, but apparently her text is quite unclear in parts. Let's take this with a grain of salt, but as you may remember, before the battle, Lu is talking to all the different champions and characters on his side, and he's asking them what they will do in the battle. "And you, Morrigan," said Lu, "what power?" "Not hard to say," she said. "I have stood fast. I shall pursue what was watched. I will be able to kill. I will be able to destroy those who might be subdued." She actually, in another part of the Battle of Mortara, she is a lover of the Dagda, and she seems to kind of curse the Fomorians. Then she told the Dagda that she would destroy Indech, the king of the Fomorians, and would take from him the blood of his heart and the kidneys of his valor. Later, she gave two handfuls of that blood to the hosts that were waiting at the Ford of the Unshin. Its name became the Ford of Destruction because of that destruction of the king. Now, it sounds like there that she's kind of hunted down and killed the king of the Fomorians. But so despite this bit where the Morrigan destroys Indech, he's actually killed later in the story by Oma. So it's not quite clear what that means. It almost feels more like she put some kind of curse on him rather than actually physically killing him, or it could just be an inconsistency. The Morrigan has also been interpreted as a goddess of the land and a goddess of sovereignty, and I have to say that I quite like the idea of her as a representation of sovereignty, because it seems to me that that represents quite a clear-eyed view of sovereignty and its origins. That if we're talking about a medieval-type society, then, you know, sovereignty, power, authority ultimately does derive from this capacity for violence. So this murderous war goddess, who has a lot of kind of grisly and often very openly sexual imagery, is quite a raw depiction of what it means to have power, what it means to have authority, in a way that like other deities that confer sovereignty don't seem to. So, you know, you can imagine Marduk conferring sovereignty on someone in quite a stately way. But the Morrigan would do it in a way that acknowledges that that sovereignty is built on blood, is built on the capability to inflict violence, is built on doing things that maybe aren't exactly honorable. And I think that that's, you know, that's a pretty clear-eyed view of what sovereignty means, of what kingship and authority mean. My position on authority has always been a little bit like Ray Smuckles from Akewood. Now I'm actually wondering if I even like kings, man. I'll see you later. I gotta take stock. So, on the one hand, the Morrigan is a very interesting figure. On the other hand, I feel that she's relatively well served by her depictions in media. Okay, they have a tendency to sexy her up. I mean, one of the things that's interesting about the Morrigan is that she's a sexual figure without necessarily being an appealing one, which I think is an interesting contrast. Whereas, you know, if you were to think about, like, what is the most common representation of the Morrigan in popular culture, it'd be Morrigan from Darkstalkers, who is, let's say, primarily presented as attractive. Now, I think this is more of a fourth edition thing, but I think the D&D deity, the Raven Queen, is very clearly meant in some sense to be the Morrigan, right? We've got the crow connection. Okay, ravens and crows aren't exactly the same, but close enough for mythology. And the idea that she's a death and sovereignty goddess. A goddess, they're maybe not so much related to death and violence, but to be honest, I don't really know very much about that later D&D mythology. I think if you took that image and made it a little less goth and a little hippier, you know, a little nastier, it would not be at all difficult to, you know, make it work for the Morrigan. So I feel like war, death, and sovereignty clerics of a weird triple goddess who demands sacrifice, but maybe almost also like affection and love from the people who want to claim sovereignty from her hands. I feel like you don't really need me to tell you how to make that deity and the clerics and indeed paladins who serve her work in your game. I think that the paladins of the Morrigan could be quite a ruthless bunch. I feel like they serve a goddess who doesn't have a whole lot of illusions about the righteousness of violence. All right, that is about all the time that we have for this episode. In the next episode, we're going to be continuing our journey through the Celtic mythos section, and we're going to talk about Nuada of the Silver Hand, the god whose job is to be not as good as Lu, and Oma, who is here described as primarily the god of knowledge, but who's the god of, like, knowledge and wrestling. So join me then for Patron Deities, a show about deities for my patrons. Thank you for listening, and thank you very much for supporting Monster Man on Patreon.